Good morning. Is this what your head sounds like?
Gotta go to the shop. 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 Go! Umbrella's broken. Coffee's broken. Everything's broken. Nothing's working. Go. Bye, 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 bye. Sound, 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 sound.
Ryan Tuberty may have just captured the soundtrack in your mind this morning, but I hope that in the midst of the frenzy, you'll have time to stop and breathe, because there was a stocking full of goodwill on the airwaves this week, all of which we'll bring you. But before we go full on festive, let's start with a notable exception to the spirit of the season.
The Grinch hated Christmas, the whole Christmas season. Please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. It could be perhaps his shoes were too tight. But I think that the most likely reason of all may have been that his heart was two sizes too small. But whatever the reason, his heart or his shoes, he stood there on Christmas Eve, hating the Who's, staring down from his cave with a sour, grinchy frown at the warm lighted windows below in the town. For he knew every Who down in Whoville beneath was busy now, hanging a mistletoe wreath. And they're hanging their stockings, he snarled with a sneer. Tomorrow is Christmas, it's practically here. Then he growled with his Grinch fingers nervously drumming, I must find some way to stop Christmas from coming.
A clip from the 1957 Dr. Seuss book, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, voiced by Keith Morrison as heard on Arena. And Jarlath Killeen of Trinity College Dublin draws the comparison between the Grinch and a much beloved figure who isn't quite as benign as we might think.
Santa Claus is a housebreaker. He does enter the house. Now, he enters the house to leave gifts. Mm. But it's actually been a long tradition, particularly in America, in the 19th century, of people arriving at your house, breaking into it and demanding food, drink, alcohol and money at Christmas, particularly the poor. So what the Grinch does, he goes back to that old tradition of breaking into the house, but this time he's stealing Christmas. He's taking Christmas away, and he's taking Christmas as it's personified in things like the gifts.
Maybe what's interesting here, because we think of him as the Scrooge figure, et cetera, et cetera, but to what extent is Dr. Seuss, in fact, making a very strong point about how commercialised Christmas had become by the time we got to the late 50s?
But that's another interesting one. Christmas has always been commercialised. People have always, right back to the 16th century, you can find people saying, it's starting too early, people are buying too much, and people are drinking and getting rowdy too much. And
you know that
the Grinch brings all the stuff back. Now, he does say there is something more about Christmas other than simply the gifts, but he brings this stuff back. So even if Christmas is something more than presents, the presents are necessary. So they personify the gift giving, this kind of season of generosity, which involves spending. It's just like the first thing Scrooge does after he becomes redeemed is buys a turkey, a huge turkey. So it's the excess involved.
Ah, so free license to spend as tradition demands. That was Jarlath Killeen with Sean Rocks on Arena. But we did promise some festive goodwill. So in a rare moment in Irish politics, peace broke out on Late Debate.
I know I'm after sort of cutting the legs off Fine Gael there in my previous comments, but I was going to try and make the point that there are so many decent people in every single political party in Leinster House.
Every single political party? Surely not. But yes, this outpouring of generosity and seasonal goodwill from Éan O'Riordan on Late Debate was prompted by the decision of Fine Gael Senator Paddy Coffey to leave political life, electing instead to spend more time with his family. Cue reflections from politicians of all hues on the hardship of their lot. Take note, Tiny Tim.
Politics is cruel, and it can be cruel from within the party regime, if you know what I'm trying to say, by people being added to tickets or put on tickets or people feeling squeezed. And I'm not saying that in this particular instance or anything else like that.
Politics is a very competitive arena.
There's no sentiment in politics. There's no sentiment at all.
No.
You know, if you're electable, you're great. If you're not,
you're just voting fodder at the end of the day, to be quite honest with you. So as you can win elections.
Let's be clear. You're a very deep view here for anyone who's thinking of voting.
When it comes down to politics, is a numbers game.
But that's exactly
it. And that's the way it is. And we accept that. That's the stark.
But that's the hard part of it. That's the cruel part, because it goes back to Aidan. There it is. There's a judgment call as to what you're like as a person, as to how you're working as a constituent. And you can have all the polls in the world, but if the people on the ground really like you and they want to re-elect you, Party HQ you sometimes need, mightn't and you actually need, and you engage need, with that
you need
part of it.
You need a very understanding backup at home.
That's definitely crucial.
I'm going to burst into tears in a minute. So I'm going to just have to move on. It's too much for me.
It might just be too much for all of us. That was Katie Hannan and the late debate panel on Tuesday. And staying with the put upon in high office.
2019 was a total hoax, the whole thing, a total witch hunt. That's why I don't recognise it. It is 2018, as far as I'm concerned. 2 more years left before the election, believe me. And I'm going to buy Greenland. I'm going to buy Greenland. By the time I finish, there'll be no snow. It'll be totally, totally melted. It's so fantastic.
Oliver Callan with Ray Darcy doing the Donald. And President Trump got the gift of impeachment this Christmas. But Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell is intent on getting the gift receipt.
In a highly unusual step, Speaker of the House continues to hem and haw about whether and when she intends to take the normal next step and transmit the House's accusations over here to the Senate. Some House Democrats imply they are withholding the articles for some kind of leverage so they can dictate the Senate process to senators. I admit, I'm not sure what leverage there is in refraining from sending us something we do not want.
Ah, President Trump, the gift that just keeps on giving. A call out for random acts of kindness on Liveline prompted people to phone in to praise a locksmith, Morgan O'Donovan. He's the man to call if you incarcerate your child into the car, inadvertently, of course. But it was this question that really got Joe going.
Give me the most unusual locksmithing jobs that you've been asked to do.
I've had a lady handcuffed to the bed.
Talk to Joe. Not. You caught me sideways there, Mark.
I don't think you were expecting that one. It was just a funny one.
And do you have a special equipment to pick the pink fluffy hand?
We do. We have a selection of picks.
And you have a pair of blinkers.
She was caught at the time, thank God.
And who phoned the locksmith in that occasion?
They actually rang their local Garda station, and the Garda station rang off them.
And can you remember?
But the bed dismantled. She was downstairs when I arrived.
What?
Yeah.
And they carried her and the bedstead down the stairs?
Yes.
And how long did you take to free this woman?
About 5 to 10 minutes. Thereabouts.
And did she say anything?
No, there was a lot of red faces, all right. That's the only thing.
Yeah. Did you say anything to her?
Well, I did ask how did it happen, and then I started to blush.
And did you charge her?
Funny enough, no.
At any stage, we'll finish on this last question and we'll move on to much more serious issues of this Christmas week. At any stage, did she say who had handcuffed her to the bed?
Well, I assume it was her husband.
And where was the key?
They broke it.
And that's what you'll get for keeping things fresh. But Joe, quite rightly, was fascinated by Morgan.
Can you open a safe?
I can. That's what I started off doing originally.
And did you spend much time in prison, Morgan? You started as a safecracker.
Yeah. I started off. That's where I
applied
my trade, yeah.
And how did you get interested in that?
I was in college doing accountancy.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work for a safe company part-time.
Okay.
And I just got interested in it, and it took on from there, and I used to go to... I used to travel Ireland, England, Wales, Scotland and Germany opening safe.
As a job, like?
As a job, yeah.
And is there such a thing that don't... Is there such a thing as safe-cracking competitions?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
There is. Yeah.
And what does that consist of?
Basically, it's a group of locksmiths, and it's whoever can manipulate or pick the lock open the fastest.
And then that's the one the Gardaí arrest first.
Yes, it is.
Funny Friday come early for Joe Duffy. But Morgan was a man happy in his work and with a particularly good outlook on life.
Morgan, are those random acts of kindness, which seem to be legion now at this stage, just other people phoning in saying they were one of the families that you got their child out of the car for nothing, and it's your policy, isn't it? If you're rescuing a child from a car, you will not charge. And what is your belief, Morgan? Is that just your background? Is that your religion?
Well,
is that your humanity?
I think we all have to be, if we're all a little bit better to each other, I think it pays off for everybody in the long run.
Morgan O'Donovan, locksmith extraordinaire, with Joe on Liveline. Now, as you might expect, there was a lot of cooking advice on the radio this week, with chefs and cooks galore saying, don't panic, just get out your Excel spreadsheet, line up your timings with a 2-second clock, take out the vegetables you prepared last October, and of course, stay calm. This is how Catherine Fulvio sees the whole thing.
I think the way to do it is to stand back and go, do you know what, it's just a big Sunday dinner. Kind of calm yourself down, take a breather and go, it's only a bit bigger than the chicken.
Things not to say to Ray Darcy, who has Kevin Dundon in studio.
And if he says to me, it's just a big chicken, I'll throw him out of Studio 10. Because we all know it's a lot more than that.
Oh, but the stakes are deathly high in the Darcy household. But both Kevin and Catherine all have an opinion on the devil's vegetable.
Now, you have tips on how to make Brussels sprouts appetising.
Well, you may laugh, Catherine.
The Brussels sprouts can be blanched the day before as well. Then you can pan fry them the next day with a bit of pancetta and then finish with toasted pine nuts and rosemary.
Before throwing them out the window. But Kevin's back.
And with the sprouts, you just need to be really careful when you cook the sprouts that you don't overcook them.
Or just so don't cook them.
Salt and boiling water for 7 minutes.
Why?
So there's still a nice crunch off them. And then when you take the Brussels sprouts off the heat, you put them into a pan.
So wrong answer.
Into a pan. And then
toss them in the bin. We'll be back and sprout free after the break. Welcome back. Elaine Stritch is a woman for whom the word formidable might have been invented. Talented, acerbic, searingly honest and unflinching in looking at her own foibles, as well as been funny as hell. She was a humdinger of a guest for Stars of Stage and Screen with Aideen Gormley.
You said at the beginning that, you know, telling the truth is what it's all about. But
yes.
Was it very hard for you just to get out in front of an audience that first time you performed Elaine Stritch at Liberty?
I only wanted to succeed.
Yeah.
I wasn't the least bit. I don't care what they knew about me. Couldn't care less. As long as what they knew about me would be interesting, vital, and entertaining. If it stopped being entertaining, I was out of there. Because what's the point of doing it? Otherwise, you're just somebody that you're a ladies who lunch. He wants to have lunch and tell you all about her sadness and everything. Who cares? Everybody knows the danger of saying, how are you? You know, because somebody's going to tell you.
And I think audiences love your honesty as well.
Well, I think audiences like honesty from the word go. They open a candy bar when you're telling a lie.
And Elaine Stritch talked about her love affair with alcohol and eventually having to stop drinking.
My mother and father were having cocktails one night with my two older sisters, Georgine and Sally. And I was almost 14, so my dad shook up what must have been a mean whiskey sour. And he gave me half. I drank it. A star was born. All at once, the room is reeling. Kaka announced dinner. Bells are pealing. They all went into the dining room. Butterflies are fluttering inside. I grabbed the cocktail shaker and detoured through the pantry and drank the other half.
You talk very candidly in At Liberty about the booze and the drink, and you talk about having, you know, you had to, you didn't go on stage without having a drink. You'd one at the beginning and one at the interval. Tell me about that changing, and tell me about the first time you went on stage
terrifying,
without a drink.
Terrifying. Yeah. Terrifying. When you've been having that little booster, any pill taker, any alcoholic today, any substance user will tell you, how did you do it? How did you do it? You know, I couldn't. I used a drink for everything. I mean, the phone rang, I drank. You know, the knock on a door, I drank. Mm. And so all drinkers know about that and identify with it. So as Michael Feinstein. You know who Michael Feinstein is? He's the guy that grew up with Gershwin and did all that stuff. But Michael put it very well when he squeezed my hand in the wings of the Hollywood Bowl, which is the first time I ever went on a stage without a drink. And he said, and you have to listen to this very carefully, Elaine, you'll stop shows again. Not tonight. Tonight, just do it. So I had to work my way around that, and it took time, and I was glad that it took time. I didn't know why isn't it just the same? Because that relaxed, powerful thing that brandy or that scotch gave me was missing. Mm-hmm. But this, you gotta wait, and you gotta see it through.
Well, as you might expect, she is not a fan of nostalgia or harking back to the good old days.
Things change, and you've got to change. You have your memories and you have your thoughts about, but I think it's much too opinionated and critical to go into things about, oh, in my day, you know, my day is today.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, I'm leaving myself wide open for it.
The mighty Elaine Stritch in conversation with Aideen Gormley on Sunday. Now, Cats is in cinemas. One to head to over the Christmas?
I guess they've been told, act like a cat. Yeah. Whatever that means.
Yeah, dodgy direction, that one.
That's quite frightening.
Mm. Yeah.
Because one of the things that they end up doing, almost all of them, in fact, is staring at one another in a very disconcerting way. The looks to me as though they're about to start having sex with one another.
I
don't want to see feline James Corden having sex with feline Judi Dench.
Yeah.
I don't. I found myself, at least, both mentally but also physically revolting from the film.
You were panicked at the end of the screening.
Get me out of here was what I was thinking. Mm. It was like being inside a nightmare or a very, very bad trip of some kind.
Yes.
Ooh, I'd be guessing that was a zero-star review from Daryl Jones on Arena. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, one particular sports story stood out.
Des Cahill is back with sports news, and unusually, we're starting with darts.
Yeah, it's a bit of girl power here, Samantha, because the first time ever a woman has beaten a man at the World Darts Championship. Anyone who's seen the pictures from the World Darts will know it's a big party. They all go in fancy dress, huge crowds. Traditionally has been far more men than women at it, but that's changing also. But last night, the number two was playing Fallon Sherrock, and she was up against Ted Evitts. She's a former World Championship runner-up. Now, she recovered from losing the opening set to beat Evitts 3-2, scoring 6 180s, a match average of over 91 in their first round contest. So listen to how the crowd celebrated her victory. She needed double 18 to finish.
So we're on the end of history. 36 left for Fallon Sherrock.
Smashes the glass ceiling and wins at the World Darts Championship. The first woman to beat a man at the World Darts Championship. Fallon Sherrock is that woman on the 17th of December 2019. She defeats Ted Evitts to write her name into the history books.
Sounds like quite the party.
It was quite a party. I can see office parties now, darts becoming trendy over the next week as they're all happening. Anyway, well done to Fallon Sherrock on that win.
Sure, Dee's mad for the darts here in Donnybrook. That was Des Bullseye Cahill on Morning Ireland. Now, Brendan O'Connor was sitting in for Marion last week, and yes, he did make Taoiseach Leo Varadkar sweat and squirm. But for the week that's in it, I'll bring you this.
Christmas songs are a very important part of Christmas for people, aren't they? Norma, what's your favourite Christmas song?
Well, the one that I remember the most is the Froggy song, Paul McCartney.
The Frog Chorus.
Bum, bum, my ee, bum, 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 my ee, play the... Because we got big, huge record player about the size of a fridge, and the first one we got, and it came with a free record, and it was... So that got played for the entire of Christmas. Bum, 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 my ee,
you'd never get tired of that
song. No.
Cathy, what about you?
I'm already tired of that song.
That was Cathy Kelly giving Norma Sheehan's bum, 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 aye, aye, short shrift with Brendan O'Connor. Last year, over 3,500 people sought asylum in Ireland, the highest figure in a decade. A recent report from the Oireachtas Committee on Justice and Equality called for either fundamental reform or, preferably, complete replacement of direct provision. On Tuesday, Mary Wilson spoke to retired High Court Judge Brian McMahon, author of the Working Group Report on the Direct Provision System in 2015. And of course, all year long, controversy around direct provision centres had made headlines.
And we've seen it this year. We saw it in Uachtaráid. We saw it in Ballinamore. We'll talk about Borrisa Cain, which has had a positive outcome in a little bit. But we've seen it in Achill, where communities are now saying no. And not just saying no, they're coming out, they are protesting, and they're telling the department, we don't want this system in our town or in our village.
Well, I'm not sure they're saying that they do not want the system or the model. They don't want the people coming in the way.
Do you think it's that? Because they say sometimes that it's the direct provision system as currently structured. Well, do you believe it's that they don't want asylum seekers?
I think that the latter-day conversion to being critics of direct provision as a model is a latter-day conversion. I think in many cases, the problems arising in these towns that we've seen is largely due to lack of communication. And I would certainly think that any town, village that is going to be visited with a proposal for direct provision, they should be consulted. That's only respecting the locals, respecting the people. And that should have been learned long ago. So I think, first of all, out of respect for the communities, they must be consulted.
So you blame, you're putting the blame there at the door of the Department of Justice.
Well, I think
a failure to communicate, which is what we've heard from the communities.
I have no difficulty in saying that.
And he went on to say what he thought should happen.
Before any department suggests that a direct provision centre should be put in a remote place, there should be an infrastructural examination of the town to see where are the weaknesses are. Have they enough schools? Have they enough teachers? Have they enough doctors? Have they transport? Because one of the big problems with direct provision centres is the location. If you locate a direct provision centre out in a rural part of Ireland where there is no transport, where they're 6 or 8 miles from a town, that is a recipe for disaster. We've learned this now. I mean, I'm not saying that we were, just because we're wiser today doesn't mean we were fools yesterday.
However, Mary Wilson wasn't entirely convinced.
Is there a different set of objections to asylum seekers coming into a rural community to what you would have if we had a new housing estate built on the edge of a small town or village and people move in as a satellite to a bigger town?
If 40 or 50 of our new citizens, and since that new system of new citizenship has been introduced in 2011, we have 125,000 new citizens in this country. Would there be the same objection if 20 Romanians came in too, who are entitled under the EU, or 20 French people, or 20 Spanish, all of whom are entitled to come in under our law?
And what do you suspect is the answer to that?
Well, I think that people aren't debating it enough. They're not thinking about it enough. And there is a lot of, what shall I say, inflammatory language. And
we're avoiding the word racism.
I am.
Is there racism?
Well, up until quite recently, I was convinced that we are not a racist community, a racist country. We have too much experience of emigration ourselves and have been at the receiving end of much of that. I would be afraid, however, that a racist mentality could be kindled, could be encouraged and by, what shall I say, inflammatory and disrespectful language in debate. We must all debate these things calmly. And if persons, and in particular if public people in public life use inflammatory language, they must be called out.
Retired Judge Brian McMahon with Mary Wilson on Drive Time. Kerry native Una Ming Kavanagh came into Ray Darcy to talk about her love of the Irish language and her book on Seo. And he asked her this.
Would you say we are a racist country?
Absolutely not. No. I think that there are racists amongst us. And I think that it's very important for the general media to amplify the right people who need it and not the racists who already have it.
Mm. Yeah. So do you reckon that they somehow have a disproportionate voice?
They do. Yes, I do think that. Yes.
Right. And why is that? Because they make good copy.
Exactly. And they bring in clicks. They bring in every single thing that is wonderful and brings traffic. And that's great. But we also have to have balance in it. And if you hear the same people over and over again talking about whatever agenda that they have, you know, it does get quite tiring.
And she highlighted the casual racism she encounters every day, which frankly is annoying at best.
Were there people like me who had been challenged on their Irishness, on how they looked, had been questioned, who had been probed about the where they were really from?
Because that's the question you've been asked over and over. But where are you really from?
So, yes.
So how does it go? Let's role play it. So I go to you. You get, you know, I say, so how are you?
Hi.
Where are you from?
Oh, I'm from Kerry.
Oh, right. Kerry. Yeah. All right. Whereabouts in Kerry?
From Tralee, yeah.
And when did you move there?
Oh, you know, I've been here all my life.
Well, but where are you really from?
And that's the moment.
That's the moment, is it?
Yes. And I know exactly what they're really asking. And it's kind of one of those things where I actually don't mind being asked if you have a genuine interest and maybe you've learned about Vietnam or you'd like to talk about Vietnam or something like that. But I find that when you don't take the first answer as the answer, then it's just simply probing. And I think people need to consider that I've been asked countless times. It's not just a once off. Mm. It's hundreds and hundreds of times.
Una Ming Kavanagh with Ray Darcy on Wednesday. Writer and actor Michael Harding was, as he put it, in the principal's office.
What'll we talk about? Asks Michael Harding as he settles into the seat. Michael,
I'm terrified.
Good morning to you. There's no need for that.
You're afraid of showing a role. You're sitting outside. It's like sitting outside the principal's office when you're sitting in the corridor waiting to come on.
Some principals can be very generous and gentle. Especially in the season of goodwill.
You can mess anywhere else, but you can't mess with Sean O'Rourke.
I wish that was true.
Kind of is, Sean. Let's face it. Well, Michael Harding, as you might expect for the season, he was in a humour both contemplative and spiritual.
I think it's as foolish to believe in God as it is not to believe in God. You know, Dawkins is only one side of a ridiculous conversation, okay? I think that it's deeper than that. There's a beautiful line by Rumi. He says, beyond the rightness and wrongness of things, there is a field. I will meet you there. And that's about love. That's about the experience of human love, which is very physical, very emotional, and not necessarily about, you know, whether you believe in God. Ezra Pound said God was bluff based on ignorance.
I know, but for instance, you've written with great affection and tenderness about your late mother. Now, I mean, would you have expected to meet your late mother in that field?
No, because she's still with me. I think that all those who have passed away are just beyond your fingertips. And I really believe that. And I pray with the saints, and I pray physically. I pray if I'm in present with an icon. I pray if I'm meditating.
But who do you pray to?
Nobody in particular. Do you have to have an object in the sentence? That's the point. That's the big mistake of Western scholastic Christianity. Mm-hmm. They made a nonsense out of thinking that they could intellectualise the concept of God. Take Islam, which is a much more beautiful and poetic way of thinking about this. They simply say that God is everywhere, or there is nothing but God. So just deal with
it. Did we not learn the same thing out of the Green Catechism?
We did, you know, but we forgot it. We forgot it. There is nothing but the beauty around us. Mm-hmm. There is nothing but the eternal moment. And even on afterlife, if you look at the Gospels, you realise Jesus is saying, don't be worried about, like, when you die. Eternal life is now. Be here now, Thich Nhat Hanh said. All those religions are saying the same thing. And I think that as we go into a huge new political culture with, say, Boris and Trump, and they'd go on and they'll become darker and all the rest of it. But I think what you'll see also rising as a counterpoint to that is a deeper sense of the universality of religion, the ecumenical sense that Islam, Christian, Hindu, Buddhist, Jew, whatever, are all in the same way making a music of love. Didn't we say God was love? So what are we talking about? Sure, it's love.
However, not everyone shared his view.
Get that communist off the air. God is the start, the middle and the end. That's why we're celebrating Christmas, Sean O'Rourke and RTE.
Absolutely. He's dead right. Who's that man, I'd say?
M. Crow in Cork now.
And he'd be given off to me about being a communist.
Well, that seems to be the charge. How do you plead?
So what we're celebrating, to be clear, at Christmas is the story of a young refugee who was pregnant and who wasn't turned away from the hostels or the houses or the compounds, but was actually given an old stable to lie in and have her baby. And we're pointing at baby an ordinary poor human child of a refugee and saying, if you don't see God there, you can stop talking about God.
Michael Harding with Sean O'Rourke. Welcome back. For the past fortnight or so, Ryan Tuberty has been asking listeners to write a letter to a special person, a person who had touched them in some way, a letter that would never be sent, a letter the recipient would most likely never receive. The letters were moving, funny, heartwarming and heartbreaking. The standout letter came from Sinead, who along with her three daughters had marked the death of her husband and their father at the age of 44. This is Aisling's letter.
Dear Daddy, I know you have been gone from our lives a few years now, but so much has happened, and every step of the way, you have been with us in our hearts. One, we've been on some amazing adventures to places like Australia, Bali, Singapore, Jamaica, and other places too, but the list would go on for a while. I know you went to Australia before me and my sisters were born, but everywhere in Sydney, Melbourne and Perth, you were with us. And Mum brought us to places you had worked and gone sightseeing too, and it was such a memorable experience. Two, the house that we live. Every day at 6 o'clock in the evening, you used to come home from work and every day we'd race to you for a hug, even after Mum said not to leave the table. And we still remember the feeling of your cold jacket and your warm hands. And the rooms in the house each hold a different presence of you there. The sitting room and watching TV, the kitchen and having Christmas dinner or Sunday roast or pancakes, brackets, yum. The garden where in the summer you'd make a barbecue and then we'd watch the sunset in the bedroom, where we'd run in to ask if we could go downstairs and watch television in the mornings on a Saturday and Sunday. And three, the necklace. A special necklace that wherever we go, it's always around our necks for luck. I miss you so much every day, but all of us will forever hold a part of you very close to our hearts. Love, your daughter, Aisling.
And now, daughter Emma.
It says, to my friends and family and everyone who's ever been there for me. As you know, my dad passed away 4 years ago, but this letter isn't going to be a sad story. It's going to be a thank you to all of my friends who have always been there to make me laugh and give me hugs when I need them and for always listening to me when I have a problem. To my family, all my aunties, uncles, grannies, granddads, even cousins, for just being there. I don't talk to them about how I feel all the time, but just the comfort of having them there, knowing that if I ever did need to talk, they'd be there. I guess my two sisters are next on the list, although they can sometimes be annoying. They are so sweet and kind. If I look upset in any way, my little sister will always run up to me and give me the biggest hug. And my older sister will ask me what's wrong and we can talk for hours about our problems, no matter how big or how small they are. But most of all, this letter is to my mum, my favourite person to see smile. She always says to me and my sisters that we're the reason she gets up in the morning. But in reality, she's the reason we get up in the morning. She is the strongest, most hardworking person I know, and there are no words to describe how amazing she is. She does everything she can to make sure we're happy, and I love her so much for that. I have the most amazing talks with her at night and I will always remember them. She notices that when something isn't right and treats every person she meets with respect, and I know I don't say it much, but thank you. This letter is to thank everyone who has made a difference to my life, and the random people who I don't know who smile at me when I walk by, who don't realise how much a smile can do to a person's day. Anyone who's ever given me a compliment or made me laugh or let me cry, and the people who helped my dad, who tried to cure him, all the doctors in the hospitals, and to everyone in St. Francis Hospice. Thank you. Love, Emma.
And finally, the youngest, Rachel.
And last one, which is written in very, very, very beautiful writing of a 9-year-old on a card, is short. And it says, dear Dad, I love you so much. I would hug you for days. And I remember when you put me on your shoulders when my legs got tired. Sometimes I find it hard to remember you, but I love you to the moon and back. Love, Rachel.
And Ryan spoke to Sinead about the letters she and her daughters had sent in.
You are bringing up three beautiful children, you know that?
I do, absolutely. Mm. And I treasure them every day. And I think how lucky I am in comparison to, you know, my poor husband. And I think for that reason, I really just want them to be, to know happiness and to be able to, you know, get up and live life and be kind to each other. And I suppose not to let the loss define their lives, but to use it to be kind to others and maybe just acknowledge what else is going on in the world around them.
Can I ask you about your husband?
You can. He was a great man, very loving, an amazing dad, and just unfortunately just, you know, was diagnosed with cancer and had, I suppose, he had 9 months. It was very quick, which was possibly good for him. But, you know, he holds such a special place in our hearts, and he always will in the girls.
And his name?
His name is Brian.
Sinead with Ryan Tuberty on Monday, and letters from her daughters, Aisling, Emma and Rachel. Paul Merton was a guest on Arena, and he was talking about Funny Ha Ha, 80 of the funniest stories ever written, an anthology he has edited. And Sean Rocks asked him about the importance of humour, healing and grief.
At the time of the death of your wife, Sarah, in 2003,
yes.
Paul,
yes.
The role that comedy played in helping you with that grief, in fact.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I do a regular show every Sunday at the Comedy Store here in London, an impro show to Comedy Store players, and Sarah died on a Monday morning at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And the following Sunday, I went down to the Comedy Store, not to perform, because I thought that might be sort of misconstrued a little bit. Who might, you know, Sarah only been dead for a few days. But I just wanted to be in the room. So I was in the room with sort of 300-400 people in the audience. I stood at the back, so nobody really knew I was there. But just to be in a place where laughter was being generated, where people were having a good time, where, because, you know, through the process of laughter, when we're laughing at something, a very funny joke or whatever it is, or a moment that we recollect or something, while we're laughing at that, we can think of nothing else. It takes over our being for that moment. So we're not worried about mortgages, we're not worried about the children's education, we're not worried about the hole in our shoe, whatever it would be. For that moment, we are taken somewhere else, and of pure joy. And I think it is the most extraordinary mechanism as human beings that we have access to. And I think it helps us through bad times. And so I knew that was the place I wanted to be. I went on stage the following week after that, because the joy of being in an audience is equaled by the joy of the performer, particularly in an improvised show when you don't know what you're going to be saying next. So we get as much of a kick from it as the audience does. So it was very important part of the whole healing process of dealing with that initial grief.
A very honest Paul Merton on Arena. Paul Howard, the pen behind Ross O'Carroll Kelly, featured on Sunday Miscellany, and he told us a story about collecting food donations as a schoolboy.
It was mostly tins, Heinz spaghetti spirals, yellow packed tomato soup, Bachelor's processed peas, Tesco's own brand prunes in their own juice, Del Monte mixed fruit cocktail, and then something so utterly revolting that I couldn't believe it was real at the time, just as I can scarcely believe it today. A full Irish breakfast in a tin. The picture on the label suggested that somehow crammed into this TARDIS-like aluminium container were 4 tablespoons of baked beans, 1 thick slice of bacon that resembled the sole of my foot when I stayed too long in a hot bath, 1/2 grilled tomato, 6 button mushrooms, and swimming in the tomato sauce, a tiny skinless sausage looking pale and apologetic like a limp penis.
Well, then, Paul Howard had an idea.
How funny would it be if we swapped around all the labels? If we took the label off the pineapple rings and stuck it on the cocky leaky soup. If we took the label off the peach slices in their own juice and stuck it on the salmon chunks in brine. If we took the label off the scotch broth and stuck it on the pear halves in syrup. So we set to work. As carefully as our clumsy adolescent fingers would allow, removing the labels from each and every tin. Halfway through the operation, my mother walked into the kitchen and asked what was going on. I told her matter-of-factly that we were swapping around the labels on all the tins we'd collected for the school bazaar. My mother was a woman with a very strong sense of right and wrong. But she also knew good comedy when she saw it. She thought about what I told her, and then she said, "I'll go and get you the good glue."
However, in January, well...
Brother Fred, first-year religion teacher, who'd been in charge of the grocery stall, welcomed us back and said he hoped we'd had a nice Christmas. "I hope you had a happier Christmas," he said, "than the woman from Enel Court who decided to make spaghetti bolognese on New Year's Day and discovered that her tin of chopped tomatoes contained black cherries in syrup. I hope you had a happier Christmas than the family from Ackle Road who were served peas on toast for their breakfast on Stephen's Day. And I certainly hope you had a happier Christmas than the woman from Ashlawn Park who, on Christmas Eve no less, emptied a tin of fruit cocktail into a trifle she was making, only to discover that it contained something so vile that I can barely bring myself to describe it to you. A full Irish breakfast in a tin."
The very funny Paul Howard as heard on Sunday Miscellany. Well, that is it for Playback for this week and for this year. Thanks to all the listeners who got in touch with suggestions for the programme, and a particularly full stocking for Ms. H, you know who you are. And we'll be back with more on January the 4th. In the meantime, have a lovely Christmas, and if in doubt, dance.